We're in Genesis chapter 37, if you want to look there. And I want us to remember again, as we head into these next few chapters, who is the main character of the Bible? We think about, you know, books, and we think about television shows and movies and everything else, and plays and opera and whatever, and there's a main character. There's one individual that is the protagonist. And in the Bible, our protagonist, our main character, our hero, is God. And so as we read through the Bible, as we study through the Bible, in every instance, in every account of every story, in everything that happens, we have to ask ourselves, what does this passage tell me about God? Because He's the main character. How does this passage relate to God? What does God have to do with these people? And when we do that, when we realize that God is the main character, and when we realize that this is a story about Him, and of course His relationship with mankind, then we'll start to see how some things that sometimes don't really seem to fit will fit. We'll see that highlighted in chapter 38. But as we look at this, we realize these are various, kind of like in a play, they have different scenes, and the scenery changes, and new people are on the stage, but the theme continues throughout the storyline. And if we remember the story of the Bible, the theme that it's following, we know God's the main character, but the theme of the Bible is the redemption of mankind. We saw their fall in just the third chapter. In just the third chapter. What was really the opening scene. I mean, you had the beginning of that God created everything, and then the opening scene, you have Adam and Eve falling from God's grace. And so everything after chapter 3 of Genesis is going to be about God's work, God's plan, God's providence, and even miraculous works to bring mankind back, to redeem them, to buy them back from the slavery of sin. That's what the Bible is all about. And if we'll remember it in that framework, then some things will make more sense to us. It will help us to understand why some of the stories are told that are told, and why some things that we wonder, well, why didn't that, why wasn't that told? Why don't we know this? We'll begin to understand why we don't know all of the things about all of these other people's lives. Because believe it or not, Adam and Eve and Noah and Abraham and Jacob and all of these other people that we come across, they're just minor characters. And if you know anything about books or movies or plays or any of that thing, when you're telling a story, and I don't want to compare the Bible to fiction in the sense of it being a story like that. But even true things, you know, true stories, you might say. But even true things, there are always major characters and minor characters and incidental characters. And that's the case with the Bible as well. Some of the people are more major characters than others. Spend a lot of time on Abraham. Very little on Ishmael. He's a minor character. He's an incidental character. So there are more major and less major, and minor and less and incidental, and then there are, you know, there's the number of people If you ever watch the credits, I know most people leave the theater before the credits roll, but I'm always curious. I've always wanted somebody to explain to me what a best boy grip is or something. But they have all these different names for all these things. But you'll find, you know, there's like first woman, and it'll have somebody's name. Crowd gathered at the market, and it'll have 10 or 15 people's names. And you think, those people were so insignificant to the story that they're just all lumped together. And they aren't even named. Well, there are people like that in the Bible as well. Jesus feeds the 5,000. Can you name any of the 5,000 he fed? No. They're just a big crowd. They're just there. They're not the story. He is. And so, when you go through the Bible looking for God's story, as we look through this, what does God have to do with this? When we come to chapter 37, a new character enters the scene. Well, not entirely new. We knew about him, but he was just a baby the last time we ran across him, so he wasn't important at that point particularly. But as Jacob is dwelling in the land where his father was a stranger, the land of Canaan, Joseph comes on the scene. Joseph is now 17 years old. Now, I don't know about you when you were 17, but I can remember me when I was 17. And I remember a lot of my friends when they were 17. I wouldn't want to be 17 again. It was fun, I guess, to be there once. And when we were there, we thought it was the greatest thing in the world to be, except for 18. That would have been better. But being 17, you know, and, oh, we could drive, and the world was our oyster at that point. Oh, we could do anything. And our future was so bright, we had to wear shades. And all of these kind of things going on. And now imagine Joseph here. He's 17. Now, he's got a lot of older brothers, 10 of them to be precise, and an older sister, and he's got one baby brother that he can pick on, but all the rest of them are going to pick on him because he's younger than them. But he's 17, and he's, like most 17-year-olds, not the wisest person in the world. And like a lot of 17-year-olds, he wants desperately to find approval and favor. He finds that with his father. And one of the ways that he finds that with his father is being what we used to call a tattletale. He was the teacher's pet. Well, his father's pet anyway. He went out and he was feeding the flock of his brethren, and he was with Bilhah's sons and with Zilpah's sons, his father's wives. And Joseph brought to his father an evil report about them. He came back from being out there and he told his father the bad things they were doing. Now, it doesn't tell us what those bad things were. I mean, you're watching sheep. I don't know what exactly you do that's bad. Maybe they weren't watching them. I don't know. Maybe they were throwing rocks at the sheep. I don't know what they were doing to them. But they were doing something, and Joseph came back and told his dad, hey, they were doing such and such to those sheep, or weren't doing such and such for the sheep, or you know, whatever it was. And he told his father about it. Well, I don't know whether they ever found out that he told on them or not. But this tells us something about Joseph's character. Joseph is one of those people who's a stickler for the rules. He likes for things to be done the way they're supposed to be done. And if somebody's not doing right, he's going to tell. He's not going to just let it go. Now, that's an important thing, because later on in his life, that kind of honesty and integrity is going to be an important thing for him. And we see that that trait is already developed here when he's 17. Now you think about a lot of 17-year-olds. And they don't have that kind of an ethic that they let it go. Oh, that, well, they're my older brother. Surely they must know. They must know what's going on. They must be getting it right. Maybe I was wrong. Maybe I misunderstood what we're supposed to be doing. But not Joseph. Verse 3 tells us that Israel loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age. And he made him a coat of many colors. I can't find a single time in Scripture where there's more than one child involved. Obviously, God loved His only Son more than any other. But when we're talking about an only child, it's a little different than when you're talking about a child with siblings. I can't find anywhere in the Bible or anywhere in my experience or in anyone's experience that I've ever known of where showing favoritism to one child over the others turned out good. Favoritism always causes problems. And it's hard. Now, we're human beings. We're never going to treat every child exactly equally. But that needs to be our goal. And of course, treating them equally doesn't mean treating them the same. I'm not going to treat my 10-year-old son the same as I treat my 7-year-old daughter. I'm going to try to be equal with them and to be fair with them. I'm not going to treat them the same. They're not the same person. That wouldn't be fair to treat them the same. But outwardly showing favoritism toward one child over the others like this always causes problems. And it does here as well. When his brethren saw that their father loved him more than them, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. They could not even talk to him. They couldn't even say, "Well, Joseph, what are we going to have for supper tonight?" They couldn't even have a conversation with him without getting angry because they hated him so much. And he'd done nothing to deserve it. It wasn't his fault. His only sin was being born too late. He was born the baby of the family. He was the son of his father's old age. It wasn't his fault. They were really angry at their dad for showing that favoritism. He never made us colorful coats. Look how he's treating that one. Now realize by the time Joseph is 17, many of these brothers are grown men, some of them probably in their 40s or even possibly 50s. And yet, they're holding this kind of hatred toward this teenage boy. Now some of them obviously are much closer in age to Joseph, but Reuben, Simeon and Levi, those first three that were born, why, they're way older. In fact, we'll see in the next chapter, chapter 38, that Judah's old enough that he's already got a grown son. His children are Joseph's age. And so, here's their hatred toward their brother. That's really anger and hatred at their father, but they're scared to lash out at their father, and so they pick on the one they can pick on. And so they turn it on Joseph. Misdirected anger. So common in our world today as well. Up to this point, Joseph's really, you know, not done anything that he shouldn't do. But here's where that lack of wisdom of a 17-year-old. I don't know if Joseph was just oblivious to the fact that his brothers hated him, I guess if they'd been treating him this way, maybe he just thought that was natural. Maybe he thought that was normal. But for whatever reason, he's not wise enough to keep his mouth shut. In verse 5, Joseph dreamed a dream and told it to his brothers. And they hated him even more. Now, I don't know if he did it on purpose. You know, sometimes the favorite knows they're the favorite and plays on that favoritism and does things to aggravate the others. Sometimes. Sometimes the favorite doesn't even realize that they're the favorite. They think somebody else is the favorite. I've heard of some situations like that where two siblings and one of them said, well, Mom and Dad always liked you better, and the other said, me? They always liked you better. Maybe the fact was they loved them both and they didn't realize. But I don't know how much Joseph knew, and the Bible doesn't tell us that. But what he does here is not real wise, considering the circumstances that his brothers already hated him. He tells them about this dream. And it wasn't just any dream, you know. It wasn't like the silly dreams that most of us have where, you know, we wake up and our car is chasing the dog instead of the dog chasing the car or something like that. You know, it's not that kind of thing. His dream meant something. They were out in the field, binding the sheaves in the field, and his sheaf rose up and stood up, and all of their sheaves stood around that one and made obeisance to my sheaf. In other words, they bowed down to mine. Now, when you've already got somebody mad at you that thinks you think you're more special than you ought to be, and you tell them you had a dream like this, well, what do you think they're going to think of you after that? Well, certainly his brothers hated him even more. His brothers said to him, shall you indeed reign over us? Or shall you indeed have dominion over us? And they hated him yet more for his dream and for his words. And if he didn't learn from that, I mean, I can understand you're 17, you're a little clueless, and you tell them that dream, but then when they react that way to it, well, in verse 9, Joseph dreamed another dream. And he told it to his brothers, too. I'm starting to think Joseph is rubbing it in. I'm really starting to think he's not so innocent in this part. He's got to realize that they don't like hearing about his dreams. In fact, they don't like hearing anything from him. But he ought to at least realize they don't want to hear about his dreams. But he told his brothers about it. I dreamed another dream. The sun and the moon and the 11 stars bowed down to me and worshipped me. Whoa, okay, well, now you got the sun and the moon and the stars. Well, again, like with dreams, there's a symbolism here, symbolic of his 11 brothers. The moon being the mother, the sun being the father. And so he told them about that dream, and he told it to his father and to his brothers. And his father rebuked him and said, what is this dream you've dreamed? Shall I and your mother and your brethren indeed come to bow down to you, to the earth? And his brothers envied him, but his father observed the saying. In other words, his father kind of wondered about that dream. Is that really going to happen? Jacob had had some experience with dreams. Remember, he saw the angels going up and down the stairway to heaven, the ladder that went up to heaven, and the angels going up and down. He had had some experiences with God speaking to him and with angels and things. So he kind of wonders about it. But, of course, the brothers are very angry. Now, there's a good chance, even though it says mother and father, probably at this point, of course, we already read about Rachel dying when she gave birth to Benjamin. And so probably when he says your mother, he's really probably talking about Leah. Leah has taken the place as the head woman in the family, if you will. She was his first wife to start with, but certainly now that Rachel's dead, the handmaids aren't going to take their place as his wife. And she's the matriarch of the family. Even though those other children, like Joseph and Benjamin, are not her children, she's still looked up to as the mother of the family. Even though they're kind of like steps children to her, they're still looked up to her as the mother. And so that's the reference here to your mother. Obviously, Rachel's already dead. She's not going to bow down to anybody else here on this earth. Well, his brothers went out to feed the flock. And Israel said to Joseph, go take them some things. I've got some things to send to them. You take it to them, check, make sure everything's okay, and then come back and tell me what's happened. And so that's what Joseph does. He goes out, he's looking for them, he's asking. He first goes to Shechem, where they supposedly were going to be feeding the flock. They're not there. He finds somebody. He says, oh, they went down to Dothan. And y'all didn't know, Dothan, Alabama was in the Bible. Yeah. Well, that's okay. Alexandria is in the Bible too, so. Now, it is interesting, you know, we get a lot of our names from biblical places in our country. A lot of them actually do come from that, from the Bible. But Joseph finally goes down and finds them. Well, they saw him a long way off. And before he got close to him, they started to conspire. They started talking about him. You ever been around somebody when they started talking bad about somebody? And it might start off kind of benign. They start off saying something kind of not very nice. And then the next person says, yeah, you know. And you know, and they add something to it that's even less nice. And then another, yeah, you're right, you know. And they add something to it that's even worse. And before long, they get this vicious cycle going where they are just shredding this person in every way they can. And I can imagine that kind of thing going on here as they see him coming and they start to talk about him and think about, what are we going to do about it? And then one, they begin to conspire against him, and one brings up the idea of killing him. And the other says, oh, you know, that's a good idea. So they conspired to slay him. And they said to one another, behold, this dreamer is coming. Come and let us slay him and cast him into some pit. And we will say that some evil beast has devoured him. And we'll see what will become of his dreams. You remember who the main character of this story is? It's not Joseph. Oh, Joseph's a major character here, but Joseph's not the main character. The main character is God. We have to keep that in mind. Because this is about, God sent Joseph those dreams for a reason. Do you think God is going to let the person that he sent those dreams to, you think those dreams aren't going to get fulfilled? Do you think these other brothers are going to be able to stop God from doing what he wants to do? Not a chance. And God always has a plan and he works something out. And here he has, they're going to kill him. And that's going to be the end of those dreams. But Reuben heard it. Reuben was the oldest, remember. Reuben heard it. And he delivered him out of their hands and said, let us not kill him. And Reuben said to them, shed no blood, but cast him into this pit that is in the wilderness, and lay no hand upon him. And why did he say that? It says that he might rid him out of their hands to deliver him to his father again. So out of the whole bunch, there was one. Now, he didn't confront them. He didn't just boldly go up to him and say, now wait a minute, I'm the oldest, and you guys are out of line. We're not going to kill our brother. You let him go back home. He didn't do it that way. He probably figured he'd have wound up dead too. But he said, well, let's not kill him. Let's just throw him in the pit. And he had the plan then that later he could come back and rescue it. You know, Reuben, being the oldest, you know, he'd lived longer. He had a little bit of wisdom. Sometimes when we're dealing with other people, we need to have some wisdom in how we deal with them. Sometimes smash face first into them is not the best way to deal with them. Sometimes it is, but sometimes it's not. And football games going on today, you know, there are some teams that stack up their line and just say, we're going to just run over you, and we're going to just pound on you until we beat you to a pulp. There are other teams that know that they can't do that. They're not big enough and strong enough to do that, and so they use a little more finesse, and they use misdirection, and they use fakes and different things like that to accomplish their goals. Sometimes when we're dealing with people, we've got to know what our strengths are and what our weaknesses are, but we've also got to know that other person to know, how am I going to approach them? Is this somebody I need to come face to face with and just stand up to them? Or is this somebody that I need to speak softly to and entreat them? And we don't always get it right, but hopefully as we get a little older and a little more practice, hopefully we get better at it. I don't know if we always do. Sometimes as we get older, we just get a little less patient with the way those people act, and we just give up on all of it. But that was Reuben's idea. He didn't confront them. He just wanted to go around them. Verse 23, when Joseph came, they took his coat and they put him in the pit. Now, there wasn't any water in this pit, so he wasn't going to drown or anything, but he also wasn't going to have anything to drink. So he couldn't be left there for too long, or Reuben would come back and find him dead. And then they sat down to eat. They lifted up their eyes and looked, and behold, there was a company of Ishmaelites. Remember that minor character Ishmael? Well, some of his descendants became merchants of a sort, and they traded goods from one place to another, and here came some of them, and they're traveling through Dothan. And so they see him, and they start thinking again. Judah says, you know, there's no profit in murder. And if we kill our brother, what are we going to get? A coat? That, you know, that's really too small for most of us. And that, what are we going to, we're going to tear it into 11 pieces and share the pieces or something? No, no. And really there were only 10 of them because Benjamin was still at home. He was too little to come out. And Reuben's not there right now. I don't know where he went, but after he got them convinced to throw Joseph in the pit and not kill him at that point, he leaves again, maybe to go watch the flock some more. Maybe it's his turn. But while they're eating, he's not there. So he doesn't have anything to say about what's going on. But Judah and the other 9 see those merchants coming, and they think, why should we kill our brother and have to hide his blood? Let's sell him. Make some money off of this deal. And everybody likes a little profit, don't they? Well, he said, let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh. And his brothers were content. So the Midianite merchants came, and they drew and lifted up Joseph out of the pit, and they sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver. Now there's 10 of them, counting Reuben, who wasn't there, but there's 10 of them. 20 pieces of silver. 2 pieces of silver each. Not exactly a real big haul, not a great value there, two pieces of silver. They sold their brother for two pieces of silver each. Well, when Reuben returned to the pit and saw that Joseph wasn't there, he tore his clothes. And he went back to his brothers and said, "The child is not, and where shall I go?" Well, you know, I don't know if they even told him what happened to Joseph. They had a pretty good way of keeping secrets. Keeping secrets seemed to run in this family. From Rebecca and Jacob, to Rachel stealing the household gods, to, I mean, these folks knew how to keep a secret. So I'm betting they thought, you know, if we don't tell Reuben about the money, we'll get to keep a little bit more for ourselves. Well, there's a good chance they never told him what happened. But they said, well, we've got his coat. So since we've got his coat, we might as well make use of it. So they took his coat and they killed one of the kids of the goats and they dipped the coat in the blood. And they sent the coat of many colors and brought it to their father and said, "We found this. Do you know whether it's your son's coat or not?" I want to notice, they never just straight up lied to him. They never said, "Hey, this is your son's coat and we think he's been killed by a wild animal." They just said, "Here's this coat. Is this your son's coat?" And they let him jump to conclusions all by himself. That way later, when he found out that Joseph was alive, he couldn't say to them, "Hey, you lied to me. Because we never told you. We just asked you if that was Joseph's coat. We didn't know." What is it they say in some of those movies where they talk about the president knowing about the aliens, but they talk about plausible deniability or something. Now that it can sound plausible to deny it, and that's what they were going for here. They wanted it to sound like they really didn't know what was going on when they knew it all. But Jacob knew the coat right away. I mean, this wasn't like he just went down to Walmart and bought his son a coat. This was handmade, one-of-a-kind coat. You'd recognize it. They knew he was going to recognize it when they asked, "Is this your son's coat?" Well, he recognized it, and he said, "It's my son's coat. An evil beast has devoured him. Joseph is without doubt rent in pieces." And he tore his clothes and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son many days. There's something we learn from Jacob here. Do you realize that when you believe a lie, how much damage it does to you? Now we know Joseph's not dead. We know he's not going to die. We know Jacob's going to get to see him again. But Jacob didn't know that. As far as Jacob is concerned, his son is dead. And he mourns for that son who's dead. Because he believes the lie, he has weeks of grief and anguish over a death that never happened. You realize what pain and suffering is caused in the religious world when people believe a lie? And it happens a lot. There are a lot of lies being peddled out there, and a lot of them are being passed off as the truth. And when people believe them, well, some of them are going to suffer eternally because they believed those lies. Some of those people may at some point come to the truth and realize that what they had been told wasn't true. But so many will believe a lie, and it will destroy their eternal soul. A lie is a horrible thing. And even the innocent person who believes a lie is going to suffer the consequences of that lie, just as Jacob did. And we talked about the deaths that he'd already experienced. Rachel, his mother dying without him even getting to be there, his father dying, and now his favorite son dies. Only he isn't really dead. But it doesn't keep Jacob from mourning. It says in verse 35 that all his sons and all his daughters, wonder how many daughters he had. It's more than one. We only knew about Dinah. But all his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted, and he said, I will go down into the grave mourning my son. Thus his father wept for him. Why? Don't you wish you could have been there to say, no, Jacob, he's still alive. If you hurry, maybe you can track down the Midianites, the Ishmaelites that have him. Maybe you could buy him back. You gotta wonder about these brothers. To watch their father suffer so, and not a one of them, oh, they came to comfort him. You want to comfort him? Tell him the truth. Tell him his son's not really dead. But remember, they hated Joseph. But they really were angry at their father. And they're taking it out on him now. Let him suffer. But the Midianites sold Joseph into Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh and a captain of the guard. You know, Joseph did some unwise things. His father made some mistakes in rearing those children, no doubt. He was a human father just like any other human father. He wasn't perfect. These brothers did some horrible things. Oh, Reuben tried to do something good, I guess. But it didn't work out. Not the way he originally wanted it to. But boy, they did some awful things. And yet, if we'll be honest with ourselves, I think we'll find that somewhere back down the line, in all of our lives, we've done some awful things too. Perhaps some of it, like the lie these boys told, was never revealed. Perhaps some of those things that we've done, we haven't repented of. Perhaps we're still carrying the burden of that sin in our hearts. I can't imagine what it must have been like for those boys every day to see their father and every day to see him mourning and suffering the loss of his son that he loved, and every day knowing, I could stop that suffering, but I won't. But you know, sometimes we hold our sin so tightly. See, like these boys, sometimes we're pretty good at keeping secrets too. We don't want to confess that sin. We won't even sometimes admit to ourselves that sin is in our lives. We just go right on, playing the part, being a hypocrite. Don't make the same mistake those brothers made. Don't keep living a lie. If there's sin in your life, get rid of it. Can you imagine what a relief it would have been to their burdened souls if just one of them had had the courage, and it does take courage, to speak up and tell the truth and say, "Dad, I don't know how to tell you this, but we did some horrible things. We were going to kill Joseph. We didn't kill him, but we did sell him. We sold him to go be a slave somewhere." They didn't know where he was going to wind up being a slave, but they knew they sold him, that he was going to be sold as a slave somewhere. They knew that. It would have taken a lot of courage to say that. But I can only imagine the relief of the burden of having to keep that secret. We'll see later on that years later, they're still carrying that burden around. Still carrying it for years. Of course they are. There's only one way to get rid of sin. It won't go away with time. The burden, the guilt, it doesn't just disappear. The only way to get rid of it as a Christian is to confess it to the Lord and repent of it. Get that thing out of there. Don't let it destroy you. Don't keep hiding it. Let me tell you, I know a grain of sand in an oyster may turn into a pearl, but a sin kept in your heart is never going to turn into anything of value. It's only going to fester and destroy your heart from the inside out. If you're here tonight and you have sin in your life that's been unresolved, get it right. Don't live another day in the misery that comes from knowing that you're in sin. If you have a need to respond tonight, please do so as we stand and as we sing.